Welcome to the Antisocial Podcast. This is episode 181 with Dr. Lila Landowski. And before we kick into the episode, did you know that I play in a heavy metal band called Lorde? That's my Iron Maiden gallop. And you can go to lorde.net.au and check out our music. We've got all of our playlists over there, streaming music, streaming links, etc. You know, all this great terminology I'm using here. Video clips, our whole back catalog's there. It's a great way to discover our music, especially if you love a bit of old school heavy metal. And also check out our brand new single called United Welcome Back. And you can check that out by going to lorde.net.au/united. The video clips there, the Australian track listing for the upcoming new album Fallen Idols is there as well. You can check out a couple of the covers that we'll be releasing. I'm looking forward to sharing those ones. And a little bit of extra information about the new album. And you can also buy the United t-shirt. You can download 20 plus preview tracks and some little introductions and explanations about the upcoming songs that Tim has provided, and heaps more. So you can go over there, lorde.net.au/united, and you can go and check it all out. New information about the upcoming new album, Fallen Idols, will be coming soon. So in the meantime, you can follow us on all the socials, but start the website and go from there. In addition to playing in a metal band, I also host the Self-Starter Podcast, which is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. Season 2 kicks off in a matter of weeks, at the beginning of June. I think it's the 3rd of June. I think that's the Monday. Season 2 will kick off and will go until December. And if you want to check out Season 1, that is still up and available. And there's about 28, 29 odd episodes from Season 1. So go over to selfstarter.com.au, or you can go and search for Self-Starter in your podcast plan. You should be able to pick up Season 1 and have a listen and tell me what you think. And also, before I wrap it up, if you have any suggestions of guests that could be on the Self-Starter podcast, I have a couple of spots left before I wrap up recording for Season 2. So hit me up if you know anybody that's running their own business or has a nice little side hustle, earns a little bit of extra coin on the side. Hit me up and let me know. I'd love to consider them for the podcast. But check it all out, lorde.net.au. selfstarter.com.au. Thank you. Shout out time. Every week I thank somebody who is just a legend, just helps me out, does something really cool. And it could be, you know, a little small thing, like just a little positive message or a bit of social media love or a guest recommendation, or it could be something huge, like buying some merch from the online store over at andysocial.net, or shouting me a beer, a little PayPal donation via the PayPal link over at andysocial.net, or whatever. You know, small, big, all these different things. It just helps. It keeps this podcast going and just keeps me sane and you know, keeps me away from breaking down and having, you know, some sort of crisis. So it means a lot to me. So thank you so much to everybody that just takes that little bit of time to just spread the love a little bit and send a little bit of love my way. So thank you so much. I've been trying to do it myself to other people because I know how good it feels. So I'm trying to practice that and put it out there into the universe myself. Isn't that nice and warm and fuzzy? Anyway, moving along. So every week I put somebody on public record. It's the least that I could do, and just send them out a little thank you. So this week's shout out is for Matthias Larsen. I'm probably fucking butchering that name. Matthias is from, Sandviken in Sweden. Sandviken. I'm probably just talking like a wanker now. Anyway, Matthias is getting a shout out because this guy is a gun on social media. He likes every freaking post I put up, whether it be on my personal page or on the podcast page. He is liking everything, interacting with it, and just passing on his social media support. You know how hard it is to get a freaking like on Facebook or Instagram, or get a like, a little love heart on Twitter. It's hard, you know, and I try not to think about it too much, but I know that the more of those little likes I get, those more of those little bloody ticks and whatever, those thumbs up or love hearts or whatever, I know that it's going to help the algorithm wizards, and it's going to make my podcast reach more and more people. So people like Matthias just mean the world to me. So Matthias, when you hear this, shoot me a message, give me your postal address, and I'm going to send you out a little thank you pack. I'm going to send it all the way to Sweden, all the way to Sandviken in Sweden. And it's just my little way of saying thank you, because that stuff just helps me big time. And I cannot like understate it. It's just little simple things like that, especially when a lot of people do it. It's just it's big. It's just big for me and for the podcast and everything I do. So thank you so much. And thank you, as always, to everybody that supports me. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Buy stuff. You can buy stuff from me. Okay, I'll have to work on that one. Did you know if you go to andysocial.net/buy stuff, you can buy a whole heap of shit from me. You can buy stuff from the Lord online store, the Dominus Records online store, the Andy Social online store. You can buy stuff from my eBay and my Discogs stores over there. The eBay stuff's got a whole range of eclectic shit that I, Jess and I own that we're just hocking off. Unwanted gifts, sorry folks. And all sorts of stuff. Music stuff, memorabilia, posters and patches and stickers, and there's lots of cool stuff over there. Go and check it out. Discogs has got a large chunk of my old school music collection on there. I'm not going to get into why I'm selling a lot of that, but go and check it all out. There's heaps of great stuff on there. If you go to andysocial.net/buy stuff, it will mean the world to me. That money goes back into the podcast and helps fund some of the other little projects that I'm working on in the background. So just a little thank you, a quick few little extra shout outs. Josephine from Maryborough in Victoria. Sorry. Bethany from Warramoo in New South Wales. I'm not making these places up, folks. These are legit places in Australia for my international listeners. Rebecca from Narim South in Victoria. I've never even been to these places before. And Dennis from Adelaide in South Australia. Yeah, we know Adelaide. So thanks, folks. Really appreciate it. And anybody that's interested, go to andysocial.net/buy stuff. Online stores for the band, for our label, for the podcast, and for my Discogs and eBay stores are all over there. So go and have a sticky beak. And please, if you order anything from any of those platforms and make a mention that you heard me freaking crapping on in this podcast intro about it all, just reference it. Say, hey, I heard you being a dick or blah, blah, blah in the podcast. Give me stuff. And I will add some extra little goodies in with your order as well. So make sure you do that. andysocial.net/buy stuff. Episode 181 is with Dr. Leela Landowski. Leela is a neuroscientist, a lecturer, a science communicator, and she is just one smart cookie. I mean, anybody that's listened to the podcast for a while will know that I have had many people on where I am completely out of my depth. You can go back and listen to some of the previous episodes with Dr. Steve Salisbury, who's a paleontologist, Dr. Tamara Davis, who's an astrophysicist, just heaps of people that I've had over the last 3.5 odd years. And Leela is another person where I just sit there in awe and just think, oh shit, did I make the right decision to get this person on the podcast? Because I've got no idea what the hell I'm talking about. And this is just no exception here. So Leela's just an amazing person. She has done amazing things over the years and is heavily involved in neuroscience and has been contributing significantly to improving the lives of others. And so we get into a lot of this in the chat and learn a lot about Leela's background and where she's come from. And it's just a really, really great chat. I'm going to have links in the show notes to everything that we discussed and contact details for Leela as well. So if you want to reach out to her and say hello, please do so, as with all the guests on the podcast. A massive shout out as well to Aaron Maxwell, who recommended Leela. Thank you, mate. I'm going to come down to Tasmania sometime soon, and we'll do a podcast to maybe have a couple of beers as well. But anyway, I get sidetracked. Thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Leela. And please enjoy this episode with Dr. Leela Landowski. First things first, I have to do a quick little shout out for someone that will be listening who introduced you to Meshuggah and recommended you to me to get onto the podcast. So a big thank you to Aaron Maxwell, who passed your name over and said you need to get this person on your podcast.
Yeah, what a legend he is too.
So how long ago was it when you were able to start telling people that you're a neuroscientist?
I think when I was studying my doctorate in neuroscience was when we could kind of technically get away with calling ourselves neuroscientists, because that's the point where you realize that you are an expert in your particular niche area of neuroscience. So I suppose that would have been as much as 8 years ago now.
So quite some time ago. You're definitely used to the term these days.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I guess when you're talking to, you know, your everyday Joe out there and someone says, oh, what do you do? It's usually one of those first questions. Do people ask you like a really odd sort of question around that when you first say what you are? Do they ask you sort of like, is there any myths that people seem to have about the role that you have?
That's a tricky question because I think it often depends on the context, and usually the context where I have those conversations, I'm either speaking to other neuroscientists or it might be a social situation, and often it'll be someone will look at me and be like, oh, you don't look like a neuroscientist. And I think, well, what does a neuroscientist look like? What does anyone in any profession look like? We are diverse beings. So pigeonholing someone in what they should look like for their profession is probably the most interesting bugbear that I have when talking about neuroscience.
And so I assume that it's been a little bit of a challenge at times over the years trying to dispel those myths, because, I mean, I think we all sort of do that in a way, even though we try not to do it, we tend to judge people on appearance. First of all, we size people up, see if they're safe, see if they're an enemy or a friend or whatever it might be. And there's a lot of unconscious bias that sits there. So just going off what you just said, no doubt you've had a number of occasions over the years where it's probably been a little bit of a challenge to try and get past that first hurdle.
Yeah. And you know what, it came to the point where I was wearing glasses because I knew that people on average would take me more seriously when I was wearing glasses if I hadn't met them before. But then it came to be that I actually now need glasses because my eyes are terrible. So, you know.
You feel better about it now. You can justify it.
Yes.
So with your field, and this is where, and I warned you today, I'm going to ask a bunch of dumb questions because I've got no clue whatsoever. But I was having a look on your LinkedIn profile and looking at sort of the way that you've summarized what you've done over the years and where you're at now, and just trying to understand exactly what your role is at the moment, because it looks like what you do, you sort of embark on a project or a number of projects, and that is sort of the focal point of what you do on a day-to-day basis. Is that sort of what it is, like explaining it in a nutshell?
Yeah, and I guess with the nature of research is that project, that fundamental project or topic that you're working on can change over time, which has certainly been the case for me. So initially I was working in peripheral nerve injury and trying to work on ways to regenerate nerves that have been damaged in a range of different diseases. And then because of funding reasons, I had to move off into other areas of research. So now I'm actually working in stroke and in fatigue, so trying to understand what's happening in our brains when we're really tired.
Oh, that's me almost every day. Every moment of the day, I'm fatigued, to say the least.
We can all relate to that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, just going back quickly to what you said before, when you were doing your previous work and then that funding ceased, no doubt that would be a frustrating situation to be in, because I'm assuming this is not light research that you casually sort of, you know, do a little bit here and there. I mean, it's in-depth work and a lot of hours are being put into the work that you're doing. So I assume that it would be a very tough thing and probably a common thing that a lot of scientists would have to go through when that funding just stops and you hit this roadblock.
Yeah, and it's, to be honest, it's demoralizing in some ways because this project becomes your baby. It's like all of this work and these ideas and these efforts suddenly get put to a standstill. And I guess in the context of that work that I was doing in peripheral nerve damage, so I'd found this natural protein which was actually able to regenerate nerves in the skin. In the model that I was looking at. So we had this potential treatment which could help people and could potentially go to clinical trials, but through the nature of research and the absence of funding, that, you know, that wonderful area of discovery that we had been working on just had to stop. And it just makes me think how many people have been working on really exciting research around the world that could have led to a treatment for people for, who knows, like, tons of different diseases that had to stop simply because of funding reasons.
Well, I think with a lot of people out there that don't have much of a grasp of this whole world, you really only hear about things when there's a bit of a news report saying that, you know, this this trial's about to kick off or this is about to be implemented. And then you start to see, oh, wow, that's exciting. But then even at that stage, you're still a long way off before it's implemented into the public system. But,
yeah, absolutely.
But that early stage, like, and what you're talking about, I mean, people just would never be exposed to this information, probably more so recently now that people have got a little bit more access to ideas and information, and podcasts are great. I mean, I've started to learn things I never thought I'd learn by listening to podcasts.
But
as you said, there'd be people all over the world that have just put in so much and are on the brink of having these groundbreaking discoveries and just stopping in their tracks.
Yeah, just the idea of being on the cusp of something that's potentially so helpful to society and then stopping, it just means that we've probably repeated a lot of experiments that someone else on the other side of the world has already done 10 years ago, and they stopped because they ran out of money.
And is there any sort of, oh man, I can go in so many directions. Is there any sort of global sort of communication around these sort of tests? Like if you're working on a particular, so the projects that you're working on now, are there other parts of the world that you're aware of, and there's other scientists who are doing research work that you're able to sort of, not so much collaborate with, but at least sort of trade some feedback? Or is it because, I don't know, from a country point of view and security and things like that, or depending on the country, you don't quite have as much access to information that way?
Yeah, I think we're becoming very much more a collaborative world when it comes to research. I think we realise that a problem shared is a problem halved, and we all have our relative expertise in science. So if you have someone who is across the world and can do a particular experiment very well because they've already been doing it for 10 years, well, what's the point of you buying the equipment and learning how to do it when you can just send the stuff to them and they can do it, and you can be both on this exciting research journey together? And that's increasingly done in science, which is fantastic.
And I assume that just off the back of that, locally, when you're going through all the red tape that no doubt you'd have to do, that these types of collaborations globally are becoming more accepted as far as the results that they're producing. It's not something where people aren't taking this other information into account because it's not within the confines of that research facility.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's becoming more encouraged now, which is fantastic to see.
And going back to the funding aspect, and I'm just having this visual in my head that there's a board of people on this table, this long table, almost like a Shark Tank sort of thing, and they've got a dollar figure above their heads of how much money they've got to spend, and all these people keep coming up, and every 6 months or every 5 years or whatever the duration is, that people are coming up and saying, this is what I'm working on, or this is my idea, and this is why I think that the money that's sitting above your heads is deserved for me. Is that kind of what happens? Is there a bit of a cycle that happens with funding where, there's only so much to go around and there's a lot of people that are gunning for it, and it's just a case that someone's prioritised somebody else over the work that you were doing?
Yeah, precisely. So the main funding body is the National Health and Medical Research. I forgot what it's called. Council. Sorry, I should know that off the top of my head. So the National Health and Medical Research Council is responsible for administering most of the research funds in Australia. And you apply for that money every year around this time of the year, and you get outcomes whether you're successful or not with that funding by, October, November, December. And they'll often only release that information whether you're successful for the funding on a slow news day. It's a very political thing. And the way that they decide who gets funded is by other researchers come together and read all these applications, and together they try and decide which project is more worthy. But a lot of the projects, because they are so worthy, it almost becomes like once you've got a pool of projects that are super worthy of being funded, it becomes very much a game of chance with who does and who doesn't. So at present it's still a flawed system, but I don't know that we have a better way of doing it.
I'm just imagining, everyone's teared off a piece of paper with all these great ideas and chucked them into a hat, because there's no better way of trying to distinguish who's going to be the most deserving of that funding.
That's right. And it's often very easy to get rid of the potential projects that don't seem like they're going to go somewhere, but there are just so many good ones that it really is almost like pulling names out of a hat. Obviously, it's a much more regulated process. I'm very much simplifying it, but of course. It is very much that way.
Would you, would there ever be a chance that that particular project that did have the funding ceased, what was it,
peripheral nerve damage,
would that ever come back into the conversation as far as having an application or a pitch put back in to be considered for funding in the future? Or is it a case that once, like, do you just apply every year and just hope that, you know, it's going to be funded again? Or is it more of a case because of you personally, you've only got so much that you can do that you just move on to that next project and that becomes your world until, you know, you can only go so far?
Yeah, I think it's possibly a bit more of the latter, in that once you've become invested in another project, there's only so many ways that you can divide your time. And the more time you actually spend in another research area, the less, I guess, you tend to lose credibility in the area of research that you've worked in before, because you simply haven't been showing evidence of working in that area. So by virtue of moving on to a new topic, you become less credible in the previous topic. So it's a bit of a catch-22.
And what would happen with all of that work that's been put in for that first project? Does it get archived anywhere? Is there somewhere that, like, does it still give value to other people that can lean back on that research in the future if somebody else decides that they want to go down that path and revitalize it or do their own version of it? Is there something that, like, it obviously just doesn't get thrown in the bin, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I guess the part of it has already been published, so it is available to other researchers to access and take forward. And also there's a depository of research where scientists can basically go in and publish, or I guess put forward in the scientific domain, research that hasn't been published in a journal per se, but for other scientists to look at and, I guess, used to inform their research going forward. So it's not all lost, but I guess the story that the individual researcher is working on does become lost over time.
And that definitely be a hard thing from that personal journey that you've had going through that process and putting so much into it that you're not able, and I think that's just a human thing, you know, I think we all strive towards something, and there's always some form of end goal that we're trying to achieve, and if we don't quite get there, there's an odd lack of fulfillment that's sort of attached to that. So no doubt that's probably, from a psychological point of view, something that's quite tough to deal with when you have to move on.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and there's something really beautiful about being able to see something through from the beginning to the end. And I think you hit the nail on the head there with that statement.
So how on earth, or why on earth, did you decide to go down this path in the first place? I mean, this has obviously been a long journey for you, but, I mean, did you have a fascination at an early age? Was there a light bulb moment along the way that thought, no, I'm going to go in this direction? And this is not just a casual job that you've sort of fallen into and over time you've just sort of picked up the ropes as you've gone along. This has been a big decision of dedication that you put in, but where's it all come from?
You know what? I'm really lucky in that I can actually pinpoint the exact moment that I knew that I wanted to go on this journey of research. And I was on a grade 4 school camp, and we're in a place called Maria Island, which is on the east coast of Tasmania. And some of us went fishing, and I caught my first fish. And I just remember holding it in my hands, and it was just covered in this disgusting slime that was sticking to my fingers. And I remember just, you know, like sticking my fingers together and then pulling it apart like webbing. and I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. And I remember seeing things on TV about shark liver oil capsules and omega-3 fish oils and how they were good for your health. So I thought, you know, maybe when I grow up, I can try and find some sort of fish extract, maybe from this slime, and use it to help people. So that's where my idea of wanting to work in medical research essentially came from fish slime.
Wow. I can only like just, I'm just reflecting back to when I was in, you know, around grade four. I certainly wasn't thinking of those things. I mean, it's quite amazing that, you know, obviously you've picked up on certain things that have triggered an interest and it's sort of fallen together in that way. It's, I pale in comparison as far as the thought processes that were going through my head at the time.
No, it's all relative though. It's all relative to exposure. Like, in previous years, the teachers would always ask, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I was always that annoying student who I didn't want to be like a fireman or a fire person or a nurse or any of the classic things that they suggest you want to be. I simply said, I don't know. And that really frustrated my teachers. So I think they were pleased that I finally found something that I could fixate myself on after that point.
And so where did it go from there as far as, you know, was it something that just you, it just became a bit of a hobby for you just to sort of engross yourself in this sort of information and just slowly build along the way? Did you, because I know a lot of people, like just reflecting on my time going through school, there were certainly people around me that had this beacon, this light, and they went for it and they just put their head down and went for it, and they're still doing the same thing that they thought of when they're in their, you know, their early teens, and they've just never wavered from it. Was it that sort of gradual progression where you just could see where you're going and that was it? Or was there sort of more sort of moments along the way that sort of further into your teens that sort of you started to see where you're going a little bit clearer?
To be honest, I really just stuck with that naive idea the whole way through, and that didn't waver at any point. I just decided that that was what I was going to do and that was the path I was going to take. And I literally stuck to that idea without unwaveringly the entire time. But I hadn't certainly intended to go into neuroscience. That was a bit more of a product of circumstances that I got into neuroscience.
How so?
I just remember I was sitting in a third year neuroscience lecture, and the lecturer was presenting some of their research. His name was Dr. Roger Chung, and I remember looking at the data that he was presenting. It was some of his own work, and I had an idea based on the data that he had shown, and I went to him afterwards and said, well, I have this idea about what you've shown, and I think I have a hypothesis that it might be slightly different to what you're suggesting. Can I explore this? And he said yes. So I found another neuroscientist who could help me answer this question that I had, and that's actually how I ended up in neuroscience. I developed an honours research project on this idea from this lecture, and I otherwise would have not ended up in neuroscience if it wasn't for that.
And so where, up until that point, I mean, what was the path? What was that vision that you were aiming toward?
Working in immunology, so I guess understanding the immune system and understanding how the body might fight off cancer. So working in that area of medical research as opposed to the neuroscience aspect.
I mean, when you were going through this study, and obviously you were in that moment where you could identify a possibility and something that you could dig in deeper and learn more about. I mean, was it just a case that that content and that information that was being explored at that time was just incredibly interesting and sort of just appealed to you more so than what you were doing before? I mean, obviously you've had this moment where you've sort of put the pieces together and you've seen something that maybe nobody else is seeing. But is it just a case that the interest there was just too much that you just couldn't ignore it?
Yeah, I think that's it. You know, being able to come up with an idea and have the opportunity to explore that, to answer that question and to take it forward, that's really exciting. Because a lot of the times in research, you might join a lab group and they're already working on a particular topic, and then they siphon you off in a particular area of research. So knowing that I could take ownership of this idea and bring it forward was, I guess, just really satisfying. Was almost, you know, it was a bit like being able to live a dream that I didn't know that I was going to be able to live.
Have you always had that sort of feeling or urge? I mean, it sounds so silly when you verbalise it, because I think we all probably deep down feel this way, but did you have that passion to be able to make a difference, to be able to help other people, to be able to find solutions to problems that, you know, a lot of people experience? Was that always there?
Yeah, I think I know this probably sounds very corny, but there's just something that would really drew me to the idea of being able to contribute to society in some way. Because society gave me so much. My teachers gave me a lot. You know, they gave me the ability to believe in myself, and I guess wanted to find some way to contribute to society to say thank you for believing in me. It was worth it.
Was that a struggle that you'd had? And I guess maybe like a lot of people sort of coming of age and growing up and trying to work out where you are in the world. Did you go through those moments where, you sort of didn't know where you fit into everything and what you were going to do or contribute to?
I don't really know how to answer
Sorry, I went really deep really quickly then, but I think
that.
just I picked up on a couple of things you said, and I think just the relatable stuff is. It's, I mean, what you do and what you have done is compared to a lot of other people, and everybody does amazing things, but the level of dedication and the time and the years that you put into it is quite incredible. And if you're looking at it on face value, you go, wow, it's quite intimidating. But just hearing some of the words and some of the things that you said, it does. I mean, there's always going to be links, and we're all like each other. And I think just even when I reflect back, I sort of think. Oh, there's a lot of things I had to go through to try and find where I fit into the world. So that's why I sort of went in that path.
We're all just people at the end of the day, and there's so much of who we are that is influenced by our childhood, our environment, things we've experienced. And a lot of the things that we do end up being kind of a coping mechanism. And maybe for me, trying to do these things was some sort of a coping mechanism from my childhood.
Do you think that you've been able to sort of tick those boxes? I mean, I think you probably forever be ticking the boxes as far as addressing a lot of things that are always there. But do you feel that you sort of really made fantastic progress from sort of responding to a lot of those earlier feelings?
I'm happy with who I am and what I've done with my life. I guess I'd be lying if I said otherwise. And I guess I find comfort in that for sure.
Being in the field that you're in, and especially the position that you hold, if I'm overly stereotyping, because I've got no clue, but I imagine you very separated from sort of the end patient, because you're in the lab, you're doing all this research work. It's very complex. There's a lot of time and effort put into it. Probably not as much, and there's probably human contact in there, of course, but as far as having the direct link and being able to touch that end person who would hopefully be impacted positively from the work that you're doing, have you ever had any moments along the way in sort of this journey of studying and learning and developing your skills and your expertise that you've been able to have those moments where you've been able to sort of reach through and touch people directly in a way that sort of you can see what your impact is doing?
Yeah, I guess whenever you give a public talk about the work that you're doing and about the brain and about how we work as individuals, there's always those moments afterwards where you're talking to people and, they reach out and say, "Hey, I learned something about myself. I now understand why I'm reacting this way," or, "I now have hope for my mother with dementia because I now better understand how to deal with or to understand the changes that she's going through and that they're not her fault." And that is a really humbling thing to be able to experience, but it certainly isn't part of the day-to-day life as a scientist.
Do you, just because of that day-to-day aspect where you're not directly there and getting these stories and this feedback, this instant feedback from people, is it sometimes hard, like maybe like a lot of us, where we sort of get just stuck into the mix of it all and you sort of lose a bit of perspective because you're so immersed in what you do? Do you sort of need that sort of connection every once in a while to sort of place you sort of mentally back on that path? Or is it something that's just so fixated in your mind that you've always got that primary motivator that just keeps you going?
It's a bit of a mixed bag, and it's something that I certainly encourage my students and the students that I've mentored over the years to do, is to get connected to the community and to, you know, go visit schools and go and give public talks, because that's the way you can actually, I guess, truly grasp the impact of the work that you're doing. But I suppose I've always been really motivated in my area of research because I love it. Like, it's hard not to be excited when you wake up in the morning and knowing that you're about to embark on a new experiment that might solve some tiny part of the puzzle that you're working on. I'm so lucky, and I get to do that every day.
Do you think that in more recent years that encouragement that you're providing your students and the people that you work with, and even what you do, getting out there into the community and communicating with people and sharing the discoveries and just the passion around these topics, do you think this is something that has only been happening in more recent years, or has become more prevalent or more common in more recent years?
Yeah, I think definitely more common in recent years. And I think it's so important, because with the advent of social media, it's so easy to spread misinformation. Like, just reading a headline that sounds compelling without actually reading the article and then pressing share, that causes so many problems, because we often see from people who, you know, you trust and they're well-meaning, but they've shared crappy science, which is not true, which is complete misinformation. When you see someone do that, you trust them, so therefore you trust that what they've shared is true. And that just creates this perpetual cycle of misinformation being spread. And that's why having these forums where we can talk to the community directly, it helps people see that, you know, yes, we're scientists, but we're not locked up in ivory towers. We are part of the fabric of your community. We're just normal people. We're not getting paid off by Big Pharma to do things. You know, we're just people.
Well, I did notice that you've got the Facebook page up and running, and I think that sort of addresses some of those topics around sort of providing a little bit more clarity around certain topics in the science community and those science-based topics to try and dispel some of, I guess, for a lack of a better term, rubbish that's out there. Have you found that this sort of has scratched a bit of an itch for you personally to be able to sort of have that additional impact, where you are having impact in the physical work that you're doing, but also being able to have an impact from a communication point of view as well?
Yeah, I hope so. I just wish I had more time for it. It's just tricky when, you know, as you know, when you do all these things that you're not getting paid for, it takes energy. So obviously I do feel that it's worthwhile, but I wish I had more time for those things, because you can see the benefit of being able to share, you know, the truths of science, and I guess trying to present science in a digestible way that people can understand.
Well, I was going to ask about that, because, you know, not everybody is equipped to get out there and talk to the public. You know, I remember reading somewhere, and I've probably heard it a bunch of times over the years, that, you know, one of the biggest fears that humans have is public speaking, and just getting in front of people and explaining anything, whether you know about the topic or not, can be quite daunting. But you've appeared to take it in your stride, I don't know whether it's a natural ability that you have, but did you have a moment where you sort of had to make that decision yourself to sort of get out there a little bit more and talk to people? Was there an adjustment that you had to go through, or did you just kind of fall into it?
Oh my goodness. I hate public speaking. It terrifies me. It like literally tears my body to pieces. It really stresses me out. And I was always so bad at public speaking. I remember, but you know, being back in grade 7 or grade 8, and I thought, you know, I know that I'm bad at this. I know it's a problem of mine, so I'm going to try and join the debating team so I can get some practice. Wow. So I was so bad that I couldn't even do debating. They wouldn't let me into the team. So I just kept trying to do it and do it more and more and more, and it's still really hard. But I just think it's so important to be communicating this science and to be communicating these messages that just has to – that, I guess, that importance has to override my fear of doing it. It's very stressful, but, you know, that's who we are. We are we get stressed about these things, and it's often very hard to overcome. Have you been stressed about public speaking? Like, is it something that's given to you?
No. I mean, I've got traumatic flashbacks of having to do the verbal or oral presentations in school, and you have the little palm card, and the teacher would strictly say, you're just to write a few dot points, don't write the whole thing out. But we would, of course, write everything out very tiny on both sides of the palm card. And it'd be a 3-minute talk, and you'd talk for about 15 seconds and quickly run back to your desk and fail. And the jelly legs, the shakes, the sweats, everything. It was just such a traumatic thing. But I think in more recent years, I think just when I sort of fell into the whole music world and started to get on stage and play and get used to being in front of people, I've certainly, I guess I wouldn't say that I'm overly confident, but I've developed a level of confidence that makes me able to handle it. But I've found that if I don't know what I'm talking about, then I'm in trouble. If I know what I'm talking about, then I've got half a chance. And that's that's really all I need to sort of get me over the line. And once you're up there and you're getting into it, then you sort of the momentum and the adrenaline sort of just pushes you through. And then afterwards you sit there shaking, wondering what just happened.
Yeah. Oh, stress. It's so useful. But I mean, if you don't know how to manage it, then it can definitely get the better of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And not that I'll steer this down a big public speaking discussion, but is there, I mean, for you, just listening to the, you know, how you described it and the challenges that you've had, I mean, you know, now when you go and do a speech somewhere, I mean, what sort of things do you think about or things that you do to try and calm your nerves before you get out there in front of people to talk?
I guess the way I deal with stress is I remind myself about the studies about stress and how we can better deal with it. And, for example, there was a study done at Harvard University where they had people who did a task, and they taught some of the people to view stress as not being a harmful process. Like, stress is good for you. It's helping you do better at this thing. You know, it's helping your pounding heart is preparing you for action, and you're breathing faster and you're sweating because it's getting more oxygen to your brain, so you're going to do better. And the other participants didn't. And the ones who learned to view the stress as being helpful were ultimately less stressed out. They were less anxious. They were more confident. And the most important thing is that the effects of the stress on the body were much less. So by acknowledging that stress is helpful, acute stress is helpful, it actually makes you perform better. So I try and tell myself, you know, this, you know, anxiety that I'm feeling now about getting on the stage, it's just my body preparing me to get ready to do this. And it doesn't work completely, but it certainly helps compared to what used to be before.
I've heard from a number of people over the years where they talk about stress and saying that, you know, there is a healthy dose of stress that people can have. And if anything, it's quite a beneficial thing for people to have because it sort of gives you flags or indicators for particular situations and how to react to situations. And so that's sort of a feeling, a mechanism that sort of gives you a little light to go, okay, I need to do something in this moment because of the way that I feel. And going off what you just said, if you're able to interpret that and appreciate those feelings, then yes, I mean, I can definitely imagine that, you know, those feelings would be, I wouldn't say welcomed, but they'd be far more accepted. And then in turn, you know, the levels of stress are going to be severely reduced in comparison to somebody who thinks that this is a massive crisis and you dwell in it. And obviously that inflames and makes the whole situation worse.
Yeah. I mean, if we don't view stress as being harmful, the science actually says that we're less likely to die. That's a very extreme view, but there's actually a lot of research that's been done on that. So acute stress, we know that acute stress, so short-term stress responding to a situation in front of us, actually makes our bodies work better. It's just that chronic stress, that's the problem. And in today's society, there are so many things that make us chronically stressed, you know, job insecurity or mortgages or, you know, being a carer. And modern society has just primed us basically to be stressed all the time. Our bodies were designed, you know, if you think about caveman days, the times where you'd experience stress would be when there's a lion chasing you or you're hunting for something. There would be really defined moments that would happen sporadically through the day. But in today's society, we're exposed to stress all the time. And that actually changes our brain.
I would assume that there'd be and I'm going to absolutely butcher this or severely dumb it down, but I would assume that there'd be some form of damage that would occur in the brain over time if, you know, you've got long-term chronic stress that's being sort of placed onto the body and the brain. Like, I think no doubt that would increase the chances of a number of different, you know, neurological diseases that would occur sort of, especially later in life, where I guess, just to butcher it, just that the brain is almost starting to burn out because of how much is being loaded on it.
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain parts of the brain that shrink as a result of chronic stress. Maybe let me give an example. We've got part of our brain called the amygdala, and you can think of that part as being a bit like the panic button center of the brain. So it's involved in processing emotions, and it drives those most primitive survival instincts. And we know that the size of your amygdala is proportional to aggressive behaviors. Across the species, you know, mice, rats, humans, monkeys. Yeah, so you don't really want to have a big amygdala, but we know that during chronic stress, your amygdala expands in size, and it also changes its connection with part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. Mm. Now, that part of the brain is our decision-making part of the brain, so it's helping us plan and be wise and strategic and decide what's socially acceptable and think and reflect. Now, when you are under chronic stress, your amygdala loses its connection to the prefrontal cortex. So the panic button center loses its connection to the decision-making center. So you become more emotional and you use less decision-making skills. So you become reactive rather than purposeful. You lose insight to whether you are doing the right thing, and you might be really impulsive. Or you might, you know, talk about, you know, you might vocalize opinions that aren't really socially appropriate because you simply aren't using your brain, aren't able to use your brain in the way that you normally would.
I know a lot of people that I think just are permanently like that, as far as impulsive and highly emotional and not rational or calculated in their thinking. So, but no doubt, I mean, I would assume that there would be a lot of, I mean, just I guess because of us as people, we've got so many variations of our makeup and environments of thing and genetics and all this sort of stuff where, yes, we've got sort of a lot of commonalities across the human body, but there's so many nuances with every single person that it'd be very difficult and to diagnose particular conditions because
people are so different. Bad. Yeah, you're so right. And the other interesting thing about, I guess, that decision-making part of the brain, it's also the last part of your brain to develop. Like, everything in your brain develops pretty early on, like by about age 13 for boys and about age 11 for women. But your prefrontal cortex, that decision-making part, doesn't actually finish developing until about age 25. Yeah. So that's why I guess some of our decision-making skills aren't as good when we're a teenager. And also on that same note, that part of the brain isn't really developed at all when you're a tot. So that's why kids can be so irrational and impulsive, because that part of their brain isn't really functional yet.
Do you think that people, I mean, it's really interesting stuff, because when you explain it like that, then at least from my point of view, I'm thinking of all the examples, even for myself, like, you know, the experiences I've had growing up over the years and where my head was at, what was in front of mind, so to speak, but also other people that I've come in contact with over the years as well. No doubt that the more that this type of information, even explained in very simple terms, would probably open up or at least encourage a hell of a lot more compassion for one another, because it's not just something that is a choice all the time as far as people's behavior. It is something that is for lack of a better term, you know, hardwired or not wired yet. It's something that's outside of that person's control in a lot of circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just because someone's really stressed for a long time and they start acting like an asshole, they might be an asshole, but it's not actually their fault. It's their brain, you know, adapting to this chronic stress. So I guess if we try and frame the way we think about how this friend or person or ourselves are behaving, and we realize that, it's not the right way to behave, but, you know, it's not that they're inherently a bad person or I'm inherently a bad person. It's just that my brain is trying to do its best. I guess that will come a long way in dispelling a lot of those fears. When we are exposed to these extreme situations, our body's priority is survival. It's not decision-making. So we kind of funnel ourselves into making really reactive and organic responses to things. And if we try and think of it in that way, that we're trying to survive, I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I think people would be... not so much just accepting of situations, but I think people would be a lot more sort of open to try and support those circumstances that do come along instead of, I guess. But then again, it's sort of like, you know, people are reacting. And so even the reaction to somebody else's actions are ingrained and something that can be outside of someone's control. So it just becomes this big cycle. And so, you know, it can be quite a mess, but it is something that's quite interesting, because I think when people have got a bit of clarity and are able to sort of look at things from a distance and see that higher view, I think it just gives you half a chance when you're in a more sort of intense situation where things are moving quickly. There's circumstances around you that, you know, you've just have just a little bit more of a chance to be able to act better in that situation or interpret that situation a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, empathy, that's where it's at. And empathy comes from understanding.
Absolutely. Just touching on your projects really quickly, I think your primary project is, and I've scribbled this down, so I'll see if I can read my handwriting, development of a new gold standard model of stroke.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Can you elaborate a little bit?
So I suppose it would help if I give you some context.
Yeah.
So we know that stroke is the second leading cause of death and disability in the world. Every 9 minutes, someone's had a stroke in Australia. And we've only got one current treatment for stroke that less than 10% of patients in Australia can have access to or eligible to use. Yeah. And only half of those will benefit. The other half will still die or be permanently disabled. So we've only got this one drug, and it has a very limited set of patients that ultimately benefit from it. But the thing is, we've actually been trying to develop drugs for stroke for about 70 years. So why do we only have one drug? And, you know, what's going wrong? And that's really where this project comes into it. So there's been over 1,000 drugs that have been developed that work in animal models of stroke, you know, in vitro and that sort of thing. But they're not working in human clinical trials. And this is a problem that my boss, Professor David Howes, having worked in the field for about 25 years, started to question. And it came down to a few things. Some of the science done previously, you know, wasn't necessarily great science. Mm. But a lot of it comes down to the way we test drugs for stroke. And when I'm talking about testing drugs for stroke, I'm talking about animal research. Mm. So that's obviously a very contentious issue, but also a very important one to talk about. So when we're testing drugs for stroke, science collectively needs to have something which has a stroke so you can test the drug. Mm. And the way that is done has its limitations. It requires the animal to be anaesthetized and for there to be surgery. And that's not what happens when a human has a stroke. Mm. So I guess the way that we test stroke drugs is not representative of what happens in a human when a human has a stroke. So we've figured out how to treat, scientists have figured out how to treat this scientifically created version of stroke, but not what actually happens in the human condition. You know, there's the immune responses and the metabolic responses in this animal model of stroke is not representative of what seems to be happening in the human. So what my job to do is to generate a brand new model of stroke, start from scratch, develop something that is much more representative of what happens in humans. So we have better outcomes that result in drugs that can actually work in clinical trials and happy, healthy animals as well. So it kind of has two-pronged benefit, you know, helping humans and also helping animals in research.
And I would assume that when you've established or identified the best way to approach these test scenarios or circumstances, that aspect of it, which is almost secondary and has become this, as you said, this two-pronged thing, that information could be then applied to a whole range of other testing situations for other research that could be used anywhere around the world. So obviously you're addressing the topic of stroke, and that's the primary driver, but you've also potentially opened up this other opportunity that can help, you know, a large number of other areas out there in the science fields.
Yeah, actually what this work driven by my boss has actually drawn attention to is the fact that maybe a lot of these animal models for all the different diseases, maybe Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, traumatic brain injury, you know, they're not sufficiently representative of what's happening in the human, which is why we're not getting really good translation of drugs that work in rats or mice to humans. We need to work on that across the board, across the sciences. You know, I feel that with stroke, we will be the people who start that movement to actually question the science that people have been doing previously and think, okay, this has its limitations. How can we improve it?
With your other project, talking about fatigue, do you find that between the projects between the two projects, do you find that there's overlap in some of the work that you do, or are they completely different things that are separate and then you just have to divide your time between the two of them, you know, appropriately?
Well, I guess the individual projects are separate, but I mean, the themes are involved. We know that, you know, everyone suffers from fatigue, and it's a symptom of so many different conditions, and it happens after you have a stroke. A lot of people complain of being fatigued. Mm. Any like severe illness, even when you've got jet lag or when you've got a very severe cold, and think of all the times that you've had a really severe cold or influenza and you've just been so fatigued that you can't get out of bed. Like there are so many different conditions that can result in this feeling of fatigue, and certainly chronic fatigue syndrome, I guess, would be a classic example. Mm. So there are overlaps, definitely, but there are a lot of differences as well. And I think from the overlaps and the differences, we can actually learn a lot more about what's going on.
Is there any particular sort of, you know, is chronic fatigue sort of the big thing that you're sort of aiming towards as far as trying to address that, or is it sort of a more of a broader approach as far as addressing just the topic of fatigue and it's all of its variations? I mean, what's the sort of direction that you sort of lead with that secondary project?
Yeah, so I think there's a point that converges somewhere in the brain where all of these different things that cause you to be fatigued converge at some point that results in the same thing, this feeling of fatigue. It just manifests itself in different amounts. So, for example, we know there are certain parts of the brain that are involved in our motivation and our reward, the reward pathways. Mm-hmm. So perhaps these parts of the brain are being affected. So that's why we don't have the impetus to get out of bed, because we can't motivate ourselves enough. And certainly from the work that we've done, it looks like those parts of the brain aren't actually getting enough energy. So when we actually look at fatigue more globally, so in the human body, say, for example, you've been running and you get muscle fatigue, your muscles aren't getting enough glucose and lactic acid is building up. So maybe something similar is happening to the brain in those parts of the in those particular areas, in the motivation centers, the reward center, those parts might not be getting enough energy to cause this feeling of fatigue.
It's a world that completely overwhelms me, and I'm extremely, I was very intimidated getting ready for tonight's conversation with you, because but incredibly impressed with what you do and what you have done. And I think one of the really cool things that I've sort of learnt on this podcast over the last few years is just interacting with people that are making a massive difference in the community and in the, you know, even on a global platform as well. And you know, I think we've all got people in our lives, or we've got our own experiences where we have to deal with our health and our bodies and our minds. And there's a lot of horrible experiences that people go through, and to know that there's people out there that are slogging it away behind closed doors, painstakingly trying to get blood out of a stone, so to speak, to try and work out what are the solutions to these problems. I mean, it's even though it's a long and it's a very long process, it's reassuring to know that there are people out there that are doing great work.
Oh, but it's such a rewarding process. Such a rewarding process.
Thank you so much. This has been really good, and I hope I didn't ask too many dumb questions.
Oh, no. It's been fantastic. It's been a real treat.
If you want to reach out to Leela, you can go to the show notes over at andysocial.net, or alternatively, you can click through on your podcast player. There'll be a bunch of clickable links in there. So get your stubby digits out and smash your little fingertips against the phone or your screen, you know, whatever it is. And there'll be a bunch of clickable links there to get in touch with Leela and check out anything that we discussed in the episode itself. And I must say, I keep crapping on about this, and I have been crapping on about it for the last 3.5, close to 4 years now. If you've got a couple of minutes, please shoot a DM or an email or a bit of social media love or whatever it might be to any of the guests that have been on the podcast today. It doesn't matter if these guests were from 3+ years ago. If you're listening to an old episode or whatever and you enjoyed it, you got something out of it, please just shoot a quick few words to these people and just let them know what you thought of it. These amazing guests have sacrificed a fair chunk of their time to sit down with me, and unfortunately cop a bit of an ear bashing at times from yours truly. So whenever these people are getting a bit of positive feedback and acknowledgement for the time that they've spent to chat to me, then what I hope is that it's validated that they made the right decision to sit down and chat for the podcast. Well, that's what I like to think anyway. But it's nice, warm, fuzzy feelings, a nice gesture. And if you've got a couple of minutes, it will go a hell of a long way. A few updates before we wrap this up. From a Lord perspective, no news, no extra new news on the new album. Well, that was a really great way of delivering that that message. Fallen Idols will be coming out this year. As I mentioned in the previous episode, if you've been listening along, we are in the midst of contractual discussions with our friends in Japan, and I'm hoping that we will be able to confirm a release date very soon. Once we've got the Japan release date, then we will announce the worldwide release date of the album as well. And we'll be able to then do things such as pre-orders, and our PR campaigns can kick off and all that sort of stuff. So we'll be looking forward to, I guess, taking the chains off and just going hard as soon as we get this little green light from our friends in Japan. In the meantime, we've announced an Australian tour, which kicks off on the 21st of June in Canberra, then goes to Brisbane on the 27th of June. Is that the 27th or the 28th of June? It's Friday anyway. Friday the 28th of June, Saturday the 29th of June in Perth, the 5th of July in Melbourne, 6th of July in Adelaide, and then the 26th of July in Sydney. You can go over to lord.net.au, check out all the tour dates, the venues, etc., and some extra details of who some of the friends are that are jumping on these bills with us as well. We've got some really cool lineups for you guys. And there will be more information about those shows as well, with regards to new merchandise, the new album, and there'll be lots of cool little surprises and fun stuff that we'll have in store for you guys. We're really excited. It's been a long time between album tours, and so we're really going to make the most of this one. So go and check it all out over at lord.net.au. And updates from Selfstarter, as mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, finishing up season two. Season two will be out at the beginning of June, which is very, very close. I am leaving things to the last minute, but I've recorded the bulk of season two. So I'm looking forward to starting to drip feed them out and share these great stories with you all. But I've got a couple of spots left to fill. So if you do know somebody that runs their own business, whether they've only just started or they've been doing it for several years or they've been doing it for decades, I'd love to get your suggestions. Or it could be somebody that just has a great side hustle and earns a little bit of extra coin on the side. So whatever it is, if you've heard Self Starter, or if you haven't, go and check it out. But if you've heard it and you get the concept of that podcast, please, if you have any suggestions, I would love to consider them. Also, I forgot to mention with the Lord stuff, calls to action. I've been mentioning this over the last several episodes. A couple of things to keep in mind. If you want to support the band and you want to get something posted out to you in the mail, leave a review somewhere on the internet for any of our releases, any of the studio albums, any of the EPs, any of the singles, any of the box sets, any of the re-recordings. We've got heaps of releases over the last 15 odd years, especially when it comes to Lord. So we would love people to get out there and go on places such as iTunes and Amazon and Metal Archives and Bandcamp. Bandcamp's a really good one for us because obviously it's linked to our online store, etc. Leave a review there. It doesn't have to be, a perfect review, 5 stars or whatever it is, 10 out of 10, an honest review goes a long way. The fact that people are talking about us goes a long way for us. And a lot of these sites that work off algorithms will certainly reward people that are spending the time to talk about us. And basically it helps us stay in the conversation, especially when we've got a new album dropping very soon. Keeping in mind being visible and being talked about, the second call to action is wearing our t-shirts. Lots of you have our t-shirts and have bought multiple t-shirts over the years. I know some people that have got something like 12 or 13 Lord t-shirts, like all different designs that we've been putting out over the years. You've got your own wardrobe, Lord wardrobe. For anybody that's going to any metal gigs, for the remainder of May, I may extend this depending on what happens with the new album, but, until the end of May, please, if you're planning to go to a metal show anywhere in the world, and this is for my international friends as well, and same with the reviews also, anybody in the world, this is not restricted to Australia, but, if you are going to a metal show, please consider wearing your Lord t-shirt, snap a photo of yourself wearing that Lord t-shirt, and then flick me a message via Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, off the contact form on the website, whatever it might be, and I will send you out a little thank you. And it's the same thing with the review as well. Shoot me just a little screenshot of what review you have left and where it is, and with your mailing address, and I'll send something out to you as well. So it's my little way of saying thanks. It's a massive help to us. It gets us in the conversation. It gets our branding visible, a little bit of marketing 101 there, and it will just help people connect the dots when we have our next big announcements that come out, hopefully very, very soon. So things to consider. If you're keen, take that on board and hit me up and let me know. I think that's about it. Heaps of podcasts coming up. I have once again gone hard and bulk recorded a bunch of great conversations. I am pretty much filled up until the end of June now, and I'm looking to continue to add to that. And I've got some fantastic guests. So looking forward to sharing them with you. Keep the guest recommendations coming. And obviously Self-Starter is kicking off soon as well. But until the meantime, keep spreading the word. And we'll talk next week. Bye-bye. See ya. Bye-bye. Larry, please.